Yes.
Senator Tom Niehaus.
Yes, sir.
Is this a good time to talk?
Anytime.
Now, I'm gonna close the door here, and I've got you on the speakerphone.
Okay.
Wanna let you know who I have in the office with me here.
Okay.
And if you're comfortable just staying on the speakerphone, I can...
That's fine with me.
Okay. I have, Patricia Hershey, who is, my legislative aide and was with me in the House when I was in the House of Representatives.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying to pick her brain a little bit and challenge our memory here on some of this stuff. And John is our legal counsel, the Senate legal counsel. As I asked him some of the retention policies and some of the questions you asked, I wanted him to be here as well. So the main purpose of my call was just to let you know, first of all, I did get the information that you sent.
Okay.
We are trying to find it, but to be honest with you, I don't know how easy it's gonna be to come up with. I thought I could probably try to answer some of the questions for you as we continue to look for information, and then see if, you know, what additional information might be required.
Mm-hmm.
We have a records retention policy in the legislature that after so many years, and I'm not even sure what, how many years it is, but the material leaves my office and goes on, it's on file, or it's taken over to the Ohio Historical Society and kept in their...
Right. It's generally, yeah, and each Senate office comes up with their own, but they're generally consistent in that after each biennium, if documents relating to a particular bill or particular legislation is no longer of administrative value, then it's sent over to the Historical Society and it's stored there. And so, with this one being a couple of General Assemblies old, most of that information is most likely in at the Historical Society, but we are looking to see. I think the stuff that's available online is probably the stuff you've already seen, the bill itself and the bill analysis.
Correct.
But Senator Niehaus has indicated his interest in calling you up, and though certainly not obligated under the public records law, I know he wants to help you try to remember what happened as best he can.
But if you've got a few minutes now, let me try to run through the questions that you asked.
Okay.
Because I, like I say, the main purpose of the call is to let you know that, you know, we're not trying to ignore it. We're just, frankly, we're gonna have difficulty tracking some of this down, and I'm not even sure how much of any of this stuff is in writing. But
mm-hmm.
First point, again, I don't have any documentation, but I have to believe that I am the one who asked for changes to the revised code based on requests from constituents. As I recall, they were members of the Republican Party. I frankly don't remember them being requested by Dwayne Wenninger. As I recall, they came more from the party officials.
The ones who were higher up in the party?
Probably at the time, most likely would have been the party chairman.
That would be Mr. Paul Hall, I guess?
No, probably back then. No, Paul wasn't the chairman then.
Bill Herdman?
Probably Bill Herdman.
Okay.
Now, again, I have to test his memory to see, but and it most likely came in the way of more of an informal inquiry that said, hey, you know, we've got this issue that we think is a bogus issue because, he clearly is qualified. He's had the training. And it appears that, you know, we may need some revisions in the revised code just to clarify what we mean by training. And so based on that, you know, simple inquiry, I would have looked into it and started talking to people up here to say, well, you know, what does this mean? What does the Ohio revised code say? What does it mean? And is this something that we ought to review? So the answer to your first question is most likely I'm the one who asked for the changes.
Mm-hmm.
And it probably happened in some sequence similar to that.
Mm-hmm.
Let me see here. It says that said documentation does not exist for question one. Tell me those individuals you remember who were involved in coming up with the idea need for. Again, probably nothing in writing, but a normal course of action would have been for me to contact the Legislative Services Commission. I don't know if you're familiar with that group.
No.
They are an independent, nonpartisan body that they basically write the statutes.
Mm-hmm.
So if I have an idea for a piece of legislation, I'll call over to the LSC and they will have an individual who sort of specializes in that area come over and meet with me, and I'll say, okay, here's my idea. Is this something that we can do? If so, how do I word it? And then they would come up with language to deal with whatever issue it was that I brought to their attention.
Mm-hmm.
So I would have gone to somebody at the Legislative Services Commission to have them draft language.
Mm-hmm.
I then would have gone to, and that's back when I was in the House, probably I would have looked around, because there are several ways that we can pass legislation. I mean, we can do it as a separate bill, or if there's another piece of relevant legislation, we can look at attaching an amendment to a piece of legislation that's already moving, as long as it is germane to the bill. So, and that determination really is made by the chairman of the committee. I think our House Legal Counsel would not necessarily weigh in on this issue unless there was a dispute, but if someone had said, wait a minute, we don't think this amendment is relevant, House Legal Counsel would have weighed in at that point and looked at it along with LSC.
Are you saying it has to be relevant to the underlying bill that it's attached to?
It typically has to be germane to the bill. So in this case...
Just because it had to do with educational requirements, I guess.
I'm sorry?
I guess probably you're saying here that because it was germane because it had to do with educational matter.
Correct. And that's because the bill it was attached to had to deal with high school diplomas, which was an educational issue. Then it would be deemed relevant to put an amendment relating to high school qualifications or post-secondary, educational qualifications.
Mm-hmm.
So, and ultimately, I mean, that guidance comes from the Supreme Court that, you get into the, I'm getting way off course here, but I think, what is it, the single subject rule? I'm not an attorney, so you have to excuse me.
Right.
But you get into the single subject rule, and the courts have struck down provisions of bills in the past because they violated the single subject rule.
Generally, the courts will presume that things are related. The reason for the provision is to prevent log rolling. They don't want things that are totally unrelated being jammed into bills at the last minute. But generally, the courts will defer to that. And in this case, I think the educational requirements are pretty easy to read. But yeah, I mean, you pulled it out right away and said it.
So that's why it was. And again, I'm going to go from memory here, but most likely I chose that bill, or I was directed to that bill by someone on our caucus staff. And I guess I should explain that, because at the time in the House, Tricia was my only assistant. When you get into issues of legislation and wanting to amend bills or introduce bills, there is a group of individuals who work directly for, in this case, they would have been working for the Speaker of the House.
Mm-hmm.
And again, there are people assigned to various committees. I'm not even sure who the caucus person was assigned to education back then. But we would have had to go to that person and say, hey, here's an issue that we'd like to deal with. We'd like to put it in this bill. What do you think? So the caucus staff person would have had to have signed off on it. The chairman of the committee would have had to have signed off on it for us to proceed. And that was only just to be able to introduce it. That was no guarantee it was going to be accepted.
Mm-hmm.
But just to move the process along of introducing it. That which gets us to the third question, and that is, what basically was the language attached specifically to deal with Mr. Winninger? And I'd have to answer that saying no, but it certainly he was a beneficiary. But one of the things that the caucus staff person would do and LSC would do is say, well, listen, you can't create a carve-out for one person. I mean...
Who else would it have been for?
Anybody who went to a career or technical school that had similar qualifications.
That was running for sheriff?
Well, or any other position.
Well, it's specifically for sheriff in 311.01b. That's one of the listed requirements if you haven't been a corporal or higher, that you have the educational requirements, and I guess which really didn't happen there was he did not have the educational requirements and he never was in a supervisory position. So therefore he would not have been qualified to be a candidate to be either elected or appointed.
Well, the board already ruled on that, separate from us.
Well, they ruled on his intent to intentionally falsify the documentation, which they found, which they acquitted him of. But that still did not, you know, like I said in the letter, even though he was found not guilty of deliberately falsifying his documentation, that did not change his educational requirements or his educational background. And that did not fit. That's the first thing I did when it was suggested for me to run was go to the ORC and find out what the qualifications were required. And, I mean, even though the jury found him, like I say, not guilty of intentionally falsifying the documents, that did not change the fact that he did not possess the educational pre-qualifications to make him a valid candidate for the office.
Okay, but I guess that was something that then could have been litigated that wasn't.
Well, whether it was litigated or not, he still did not have the education requirements to be a candidate, which I don't know. I was not here when all that happened. We moved here right at the end of that, and I didn't, frankly, you know, I didn't even think about running for sheriff until after I got out of the police academy, and it was suggested to me by the fellow investigator who used to be chief deputy. But I'm just saying, if you don't, you can't be elected or appointed. Now, I don't know how that got through. I don't know if that was the judge or whoever's responsibility that was, but from what I've researched, it looks like Mr. Wenninger was actually in the sheriff's department acting as a sheriff, but not really a valid sheriff, which brings into question maybe some legal points of did he do anything that would require, you know, that might be nullified because he was not actually, you know, I don't know. I haven't looked back that far on all that.
Well, to a certain extent, you have to forgive me, I'm not an attorney, but to a certain extent, I'm not sure how that is relevant to the current situation because let's assume everything that you're saying is correct.
Mm-hmm.
He subsequently did stand for re-election.
Yeah, well, the only way he could do re-election here is because this got passed.
Well, yeah, but that, I guess in a sense it's irrelevant because let's say he stood for election, forget re-election, that when he came up for re-election, at that time he had the years of supervisory experience and the educational experience.
Well, I discussed this with my friend that worked down here as a prosecutor. She's a prosecutor in the world court right now in The Hague, Linda. She retired from the Air Force as a judge after 12 years, and she came and worked here for a while. And I was discussing this with her, and I can't remember exactly what she said at the time, but that's like putting the cart before the horse. And to say, you see, the fact is that he was never qualified to even be appointed or elected, the code says, unless you have those qualifications to start with.
Well, again, excuse me for interrupting, but that's really not our issue in terms of
yeah, and I'd agree right now.
Let me finish.
Okay.
It's not our issue in terms of whether he's qualified or not, but it, again, not being an attorney, forget the fact he was serving as sheriff. He, in fact, was in a supervisory position for 4 years. So whether or not he was sheriff, I guess to a certain extent in my mind, would be irrelevant because he was in a supervisory capacity. And based on what you've outlined here, those years as a supervisor, forgetting his educational background and forgetting his title of sheriff, would have qualified him to be sheriff when he ran the second time. I guess that's all I'm saying.
Well, I can understand that point of view. Going before we get to the other two questions here, the way I look at it is this. When the legislature made those requirements for, and there are requirements, I think, for every position in government that you have to meet before you qualify to be elected or appointed to them. But when they made those requirements, they were made for a reason. And it's like, if you want to look at what happened here in Brown County, from my perspective of being a new resident, is the fact that in a sense, we are paying him through all these settlements and everything, and now CORSA pays for it, but like what I've heard now is that there's several more lawsuits that are still going on this, and we might even lose our coverage by CORSA because of some of his actions. And I mean, essentially what you're saying is that we're paying him to get the experience while on the job so he can continue to be the sheriff when he should have never been in the first place, from my perspective. But I think it's more important to find out. I mean, like I said, the coincidence of this was just too much. It's absolutely amazing to me to find out and to say that, you know, why would you lower the qualifications required for a position? Because this is exactly what happens. I mean, the people aren't qualified for something. They haven't the slightest clue what they're doing. And I'm sure you know some of the other things that happened in the county as far as Mr. Wininger is concerned.
Well, let me make the point, though. I don't believe we did lower the qualifications. We simply recognized that there was additional training over and above training that was under the auspices of the Ohio Board of Regents. And I can't remember, was it the state? There was a separate entity that basically acted as the, in the same capacity as the Ohio Board of Regents, called the State Board of
Career College and School.
Okay. They essentially had the same oversight responsibility for these career and technical schools, just like the Board of Regents had for the post-secondary schools at the colleges and universities. And so we didn't lower the standards. We simply said that training at one of the accredited career and technical schools was the same as, you know, training that was under the auspices of the Board of Regents. You simply had two different state agencies who regulated the training and accredited the training.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a graduate of one of those accredited programs.
Right.
And so, this is probably easier for me to do because I don't have the background that you and the Senate are doing this, but the really simple way from the Senate perspective to look at this is that the law was changed, and it's really kind of a pretty simple change, like the Senator was saying. It's just essentially making that education equivalent to the portion that's already in that same statute. And then whether or not Mr. Wininger, fits within that category or not, you know, that's something for somebody else to decide. That's for the county prosecutor, that's for the court to decide. But the really simple part was the legislature as a whole determined that when they looked at that the State Board of Career Colleges and Schools, the certificate received from that, was the equivalent or was seen to be close enough that it would qualify somebody to be in that position. And that's all they changed. Now, did the situation with Mr. Wininger probably bring this to the surface? I mean, I think we all know that probably is the case. And that's how things usually happen. Usually there's a particular situation that is the stimulus for legislation. But as far as the actual effect of what was passed in the legislature, that's kind of outside of our, you know, how that statute is interpreted after the fact and then how it relates to a particular case is something for different branches of government.
Okay.
Unless you have any other questions on that point, I was going to move to 3 and 4 regarding the emergency language. Typically, an emergency clause is added because under normal circumstances, when the bill is passed, it takes 90 days for it to be, it becomes effective 90 days after the governor has signed the bill.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, an emergency clause is added in situations where there's a deadline that has to be met, or in this case, I'm just reading from the from the act itself, from the bill itself, and it's on page 6 of the bill, and you may already have this in section 3. This act is hereby declared an emergency. The reason for such necessity is that the number of living veterans of World War II and the Korean conflict is decreasing each day, and the sacrifices they made by foregoing the completion of their own education should be acknowledged and honored without delay. So essentially, you know, what the legislature was saying is, you know, we don't want to wait another 90 days. There may, in fact, have even been some veterans, again, as John mentioned, there were probably some veterans who brought to the attention of a legislator that, hey, some of us didn't get our high school diplomas because we were drafted. individuals were elderly and Korean War veterans were dying, and that the emergency clause was added to address the issue of anybody who was eligible for this, for the benefits of this legislation, that, you know, frankly might die between the day the legislature passed the bill and it becoming effective. So that's why the emergency clause was added. It had nothing to do with, this case, Weininger's situation. There may in fact have been other amendments added. I really don't know. But the emergency clause was purely added to, for the benefit of the veterans who might otherwise have passed away without their high school diploma, had it not been enacted.
Okay.
And that isn't, I have seen that in similar types of situations. That's not unusual that when there's a class of people like that, that, that in this case were dying or where that class of people things could change, that, that they would put an emergency clause in. And the standard is it two-thirds under?
It has to be a two-thirds majority.
So it requires a super majority there to have something like that pass. It's not the majority of the.
Okay.
I was just trying to scan through here to see. Now, those were at least the questions that were enumerated. I didn't know, were there some other ones in here that I missed?
No, those were the main ones that I was wondering about. Because, I mean, it was awful coincidental that the actual day it was enacted was the actual day that he put his petitions in, which made him then, because of the change, then he did become, he did meet the qualifications to run as a candidate the second time.
Well,
because of that language in that bill.
I'm not sure if it was a coincidence or not. I mean, frankly, he could have chosen that date.
Well, I mean, the bill got passed in time for him to qualify, okay?
Well, but
whereas the bill had been a couple of days later, I think. I forget, I don't have the dates, the thing in front of me. He would not have been qualified again. But I don't know, it just strikes me as odd that, you know, and I know you can say, well, the requirements weren't reduced. You could say, well, they were expanded. But I wonder how many other candidates for sheriff that year would be affected by that. I'd have to check into that.
For that year, I wouldn't know, but for every subsequent year, that's a good question. I don't know either.
Yeah, because, I mean, if it's going to put somebody in the office, you know, that doesn't have the experience, then, I mean, look at the condition we get into. And, I mean, it's costing this county tons of money. And it's a legitimate question, that's all.
Yeah, but I guess where I would contest one thing you said, and that is, it didn't put him into office. It simply enabled him to run for office.
Well, that's true. Well, that's true.
Now, if you would say, well, you know, you put him in a position to become sheriff, well, yeah, that legislation certainly clarified it. The court had already ruled, at least on the knowingly falsifying. Now, you know, you could argue, well, somebody, you know, if he had filed again, somebody would have filed suit saying, well, no, he's not qualified, and that could have gone through the courts.
Well, I think there was an objection that was presented to the Board of Elections about that, because the person who was running against him in 2004 just happened to be my boss out at Sardinia, the chief of police, which was K.O. Martin. He's a Republican.
Sure, I know K.O.
Yeah. I think it was his wife that raised the objection about the qualifications, and that's when this came down and coincided with the day that he filed his petitions, which actually made him then eligible to be a candidate.
Well, what I'm guessing is that, and I'm going out on a limb here, probably John will reach across the desk and strangle me, but you know, our legislation passed and was effective immediately upon signature of the governor.
Right, 10 days after, yeah.
We don't control when the governor signs it, first of all, so.
Well, I don't think it was signed by the governor. I think it was the one where it became law because, you know, he was out or whatever, you know how they do it down in, I'm not a legislative guru,
yeah.
But I think it was one of those bills that became law after 10 days because of such and such.
That I don't know, but even, I guess that would just sort of reinforce what I was going to say, and that is there's no way it could have been timed to help with when Dwayne Weininger would file his petitions, because number one, he would not known when it was going to get passed. He would not have known that the governor wasn't going to sign it immediately. He wouldn't have known that it was going to lay on the table, as we say, lay on the table for 10 days.
Mm-hmm.
And my guess is what happened is that all Wettinger did was wait until it was effective.
Yeah, I don't think he would have known.
The earliest opportunity is my guess.
Yeah, I don't think he would have known. The only other thing I can say, because I've been asking other people around here, and there's a person who is in the Republican Party, and I can't say for sure if that person was there or not, but they said they overheard you say, I'll take care of it. Now, I don't know if that means about this or that or whatever, but I can talk to that person again and find out.
Yeah. I'd be glad to talk to them and see. I say that a lot to people when they bring issues up. Yeah, I'll take care of it. Well, that doesn't mean I'm going to get it done. It means I'm going to try to get it done. But
well, if you did, it was a good job.
But again, you know, being one person, you know, I may take care of it, but I get up to Columbus in the House, I need the 49 other people to agree with me.
Right.
In the Senate, I need 16 other people to agree with me.
Right.
So, I'd be happy to talk with the person that overheard that conversation, and there's no doubt in my mind that I said, yeah, I'll look at it, or it would be unusual for me to say I'll take care of it. Typically what I say is, well, I'll look at it and check it out.
Well,
because there's no guarantee I can take care of it.
Yeah. I had, as you see, I sent the letter to several different reps. There's four of them that are still in there. And I did hear back from one, and they were looking into some things. So we'll see how it pans out. I appreciate you calling me and telling me what you had to say.
Well, I guess my question is, do you need additional information from us based on the letter that you sent?
Are you going to send me hard copy, what you told me, more or less?
I mean, I'm not sure. Is there any reason to do that? I didn't keep a verbatim transcript. I tried to outline it.
I'd appreciate it if you just send me, you know, an answer and reply, hard copy of that, because you know I don't want to misquote you.
Hey, if the attorney, I think our answer would be to your public records request that we don't have documents responsive, and I think the rest is just Senator Diaz trying to recall to the best of his ability, but certainly not anything that he recalls with any concreteness. I'm not sure that's something we're required to do for public records, and we would be comfortable doing.
I'll consult with John on this, but you know, what I would be willing to do is just basically send a letter saying, just acknowledging that we spoke today, that you know that I recounted, you know, the best of my recollection, the circumstances surrounding this legislation, and tried to answer the five specific questions that you posed, and you know, so that you've got something that shows, yeah, we did talk.
Yeah. Okay. That's fine.
Okay.
I appreciate you calling.
All right. You have a good day.
Thank you, Senator.
All right.
Bye-bye.